Welcome to For the Love of Conversation, the podcast that grew out of 3 Minute Storyteller, where we believe conversations connect us and social change begins with the stories we tell. At 3 Minute Storyteller, we share digital stories, video snippets of intimate, messy, expansive conversations with a wildly eclectic bunch of artists, scientists, leaders of all stripes, all who are legendary change agents. Some you may know, and hopefully many you don't. This podcast is the opportunity to bring you into the full conversation. I'm Shannon Mannon, along with my husband Mike and our VW bus Scarlett, who we've outfitted into an awesome mobile storytelling unit. We invite you into the full conversation with us. We're so glad you're along for the ride. On this episode of For the Love of Conversation, it's my total joy to bring you Elizabeth Lesser. I have read and followed and admired Elizabeth for many years for many reasons. Her writing and teaching and speaking on spirituality and our mind-body connection and relationships and creativity had such a profound impact on me. She's also the founder of the Omega Institute, the largest adult education center in the United States that's focused on wellness and spirituality. So I got the chance to sit down with Elizabeth in New York City last spring. And if you read the essay I wrote to accompany the 3 minute video of Elizabeth over on our site, I think you'll see that it was pretty confessional. So what else have I got to lose by continuing to lay it out there? Let me just tell you that I completely rewrote that essay at least 3 different times, which is something I really never, ever do. Because despite what Elizabeth taught me in our conversation, there still was this small kernel inside of me that just wanted to impress my teacher. So I found that this writing process really helped me clarify and work through some of these big feelings. And throughout this entire process, I've held my hand to my heart and reminded myself that I'm still a work in progress. And maybe what counts, as Elizabeth tells us in this conversation, is that I'm here and I'm trying, and that's enough. So one last thing before I turn you over to Queen Elizabeth. I have to give a big shout out to our Emmy Award-winning sound man extraordinaire, Paul Pazika. We recorded this conversation before we had the intention of turning it into a podcast, and you could tell. So Paul was able to work his magic on it so that we could bring you this wise and wonderful conversation with Elizabeth. And we're so grateful to him and his work. Okay, now here she is, Elizabeth Lesser. I guess first, before we talk about Marrow, I just feel like I should start by just saying, I'm really sorry about your loss of Maggie. I just feel like I know her now, and it was such a love letter to her, and I just felt like I couldn't start this conversation without first saying, like, this is your sister, and it's an exquisite book.
Thanks. Thank you for saying that.
She was, you could just feel her spirit in the pages, so you just captured, obviously I didn't know her, but I imagine you captured her.
I hope so.
I hope. Your whole world agrees that this is your sister here. One of the things I wanted to ask you about is jumping right into the deep end, ourselves. you start the journey a little bit doing some research into cellular biology once you realize you have to have this bone marrow harvesting. And then from there, you kind of write this beautiful stuff about sort of the metaphor our cells present to our lives in terms of attack and reject, and then also like their constant rejuvenation. And I just feel like at a really basic level, like there's so much of the human condition that our cells have to teach us.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you could talk about that, or how did you get to describe it?
Sure. I'm the kind of person who, when a difficult situation comes up, I have to research the heck out of it. I know there's all different kinds of people. Some people, when a medical thing happens or any trauma, you know, you don't want to know anything. It's like, nah, 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 nah. Like, don't tell me anything. Just tell me what to do. But I'm the opposite. I have to know everything. That kind of makes me calm to have all the facts. So when it turned out that I was a perfect genetic match for my sister's bone marrow transplant, I wanted to know, what does that mean? Like, what is the bone marrow? Like, I've roasted a chicken and looked at the bone, but I don't really even know what that means. This word marrow, what's going on in the marrow of the bones that's what they need from me to put into my sister who has lymphoma? So I wanted to figure that out. And I just discovered inside you right now, like if you put your hand on your thigh bone and pressed hard on that bone, you'd be like, oh my God, there's a miracle right now going on in you and me in this deep, deep center of our big bones, of all of our bones. And what's going on in there is that's where the stem cells live. We hear this word stem cells. What does that even mean? There's these cells in our body right now that are undifferentiated. They're not a brain cell, they're not a hair cell or skin cell or all the different cells we have. They're just a cell, an energy source. And when the body needs new cells, like your cells are always dying, and when your body needs new cells, these stem cells go out through the bones. And on their journey through the bloodstream to organs or skin, they become the differentiated cell. They know what they need to be, and they're like salmon. They like swim upstream and find where they need to go, and they become that cell. And so when someone needs a bone marrow transplant, they need healthy stem cells that will populate the body with health and new cells. And when I found that out, I was like, wow, I want my stem cells to be really, really ready to go into my sister, because two things can happen. Either my cells would get into her body and say, hey, this isn't where I'm supposed to be. I'm going to attack this new place. It's not me. It's other. There's me and there's other. Attack. Sound familiar? And then, or my cells could get into my sister's body and same thing, not me, reject. And they call it rejection or attack in the medical world. And so being the kind of mind-body, woo-woo spiritual person I am, I had this thought, I want my sister and me to teach our cells not to reject, not to attack. And we had a history of doing that as sisters. I mean, we loved each other a lot, but we also had a long history of rejection and attack. So we did this amazing process of going back and revisiting instances from little girls on the school bus saying, don't sit next to me kind of thing, all the way through much more serious rejections and attacks as adults. And in the crucible of having to clean this up quickly, because she would die within a few weeks if she didn't have the transplant, we cleaned up our relationship and we just created this field of openness and love for the transplant to happen in.
So I'm also one of three girls. So your book resonated with me on such a profound level. And one of the fun things I never thought of in my own sisterhood that and I'm like, is this an inside joke for all sisters? The naming, literally, like the language you use, like you guys were, if I say it how you say it, Kelly Majo.
Kayla Majo.
Kayla Majo, okay, mm-hmm. So that's the thing. My sisters and I were Sam, Shen, and Amy Megan, but I was like, do we all do this secretly? Do we all make ourselves this identity group through language? And probably you guys were little when you did that. My sisters and I were like little when we did that. I don't know. It's like we have this nucleus that's very safe and protected until it's limiting, you know, and that ebb and flow of like the safety and then the limits.
Right.
That ebb and flow throughout our life.
Like,
okay, it's our first identity group that we crave as humans and connection. And then it's really stifling because that's who I am in this little space that I can't bust out of.
That's well said. Yeah.
Thank you, but it's like this tension.
It is.
So much of your book, I think anyone who's a sister or even a sibling or human could relate to what you wrote about. Uh-huh. But I just was wondering if you could begin to talk about that, holding that tension softly,
yeah,
and your struggle in working through all
right.
of that.
Right. Right. Yeah, the sibling society that you land in. And, you know, some people are only children, and that's a fascinating situation I'd love to know more about, but I definitely grew up in a sibling society. I'm always amazed that psychological work is so focused on the parents. Of course, the parents are big, but the siblings seem to me just as big. As in my family, they were, because I had kind of hands-off parents. Like, they were definitely our parents, but, like, we were somewhat feral children. And so the sisterhood was really important. We kind of parented each other and sistered each other, but we were so critical to each other in both safety and also that, as you say, that sense of identity. Some of it we like who we are in our sister's eyes, but some of it feels like a prison of identity. And as you start to grow up, you feel you're growing out of whatever. Like in my family, I was labeled by my sisters like the bossy, the princess, the one who thought she was better than everyone else. And like, I began in the hard knocks of life to really shed a lot of those personality traits, or at least I thought I was. But you go home, and the one who was the shy, scared one is forever the shy, scared one, or the one who's the out-in-the-world one, or the brave one. Like, we all grow so much. We round ourselves out in the rest of the world, but you go home, and that's who you are, especially with your siblings, I feel, even more so than with your parents. So I have always felt that tension with my sisters, like, there's nowhere I feel more loved and seen and safe and understood. And there's nowhere I feel as judged and as made fun of and as categorized in a way that I don't even feel I fit anymore. So I really have felt that tension with my sisters. Like, yes, keep me safe, and I'm your sister. And then please let me go and see me who I am the way the rest of the world sees me.
It's so true. I mean, it's so, because they can hurt, it's like a hurt that no one else can hurt you to that.
That's correct,
more.
Yeah.
On both sides,
yeah,
of it, or the, you know,
yeah,
you feel safe. I'm thinking about your, we sort of talked about this a little bit off camera, and it was so beautiful, but one of the big things I wanted to talk to you about is this idea that we're not necessarily taught in any of our major institutions what it means to be human, and that one, that's even something named, that it takes work and it takes a journey and a focus to become, mm-hmm, whoever we can be, this mystery of how that all plays out. And because we don't name it in our homes or our houses of worship or education centers, maybe it doesn't happen as consciously as it could. And I'm thinking, you had this quote from Eric Fromm in The Art of Loving in your book. I can read it to you. I don't know. You probably haven't memorized, but in spite of the deep-seated craving for love, almost everything else is considered to be more important than love. Success, prestige, money, power, almost all of our energy is used for the learning of how to achieve these aims, and almost none on the art of loving. I just wanted to talk to you about that. One, I think because of Omega, and sort of maybe that's some of where that came from. And two, you really learned the art of loving. And like, I look at yourself, your harvesting numbers being like kind of off the charts. And I'm like, that to me feels like something you can point to say, my spiritual work has,
it's
right?
Really touching.
Yeah, it works, kind of.
Well,
there's not much we can point to in,
yeah,
this journey.
Right. You know, they call it spiritual practice, mm-hmm, for a reason. Practice. Let's say, I remember when my boys were young, and they, even though they were kind of short and skinny guys, they of course thought they were going to be in the NBA. So they went, they practiced drills like constantly, or like if you want to be a musician, you practice scales. And you're not doing this to become great at scales or great at drills. You're doing it to become an athlete or an artist. So spiritual practice, and I consider that going to therapy, which I consider a spiritual practice, or meditation, or prayer, or just reading wisdom. It's practice the same way practicing scales or drills are. You do it over and over and over because it actually does work. And it does lead to the art of loving. The same way scales leads to the art of being a great pianist or being a great basketball player. So people will say to me, "I tried meditation, it's really boring." I'm like, "Yeah, it really is boring. You just sit there and watch your insane mind run its numbers." But that's the point. You have to do it over and over and over, and it does get you somewhere. And it's good to actually set for you an idea of, well, where would I like it to get me? Like if you're practicing jazz piano, you want to get to be a jazz player. But for me, the goal of my path has always been to be more loving. It's not necessarily to peer beyond the great mystery of life and death and know exactly where I'm going. And it's more like, I think the reason for being here as humans is to love. I don't know why I think that. It seems some other people have thought that too. I do think the core of most religions is love, meaning knowing our oneness with each other. That's not, I don't mean that in some sort of like airy-fairy way. I mean like down to our cells, we are one being, we are a species, we are of this planet. Could we learn to live together? And the answer is yes, if we can love. So that's been the goal of my spiritual work. And have I made progress? Yes, I measure it like this every day. Little progress, like in a marriage, the progress is, you can measure it in a parenting, in your colleagues at work. There are ways, and it shows up, it's not rocket science. Wow, I was more loving today, and love came back to me. Well,
I have to make you talk about it
okay,
because I
all
know you're
right.
probably being humble, but it was, can you tell?
I will. I mean, some people have said that a proof of how much I loved my sister was what happened in the bone marrow harvest. I'd like to think it's true, maybe it is, that when you go to have your marrow harvested, what they're looking for is millions of stem cells. And they need at least 5 million, and it would be great if they got more. And sometimes it'll take as long as 2 days on this machine you're hooked up to harvest these cells. And so within just a few hours, I actually produced 3 times more cells than they needed, and they shut the whole thing down. And I was sure something had gone wrong, but really they were like, "Oh, wow, you're a champion marrow cell producer." And some people have said, "Well, that's proof of how well you loved your sister," and that would be nice if that's the truth. I certainly had like prayed and prayed on my body to like give everything you can, and I had done the work with my sister to clean up our relationship, and I think that that had an effect.
I thank you for saying that because I was going to say you said intentions, you talk to yourself. I mean, I know we're getting woo-woo, but that's what you mean.
Yeah.
But you talk to them. This is your body. You did the therapy. I mean, most
Mm-hmm.
of all, you sat in that hard space and had those
Yeah.
courageous conversations with your sister. It's incredible.
Yeah, I think the people will say you were so courageous to give your bone marrow. I don't really think so, because it's not that terribly hard or painful an ordeal to go through. And I think you'd have to be a kind of crappy person to say, no, I don't think I'll save my sibling's life. Thank you anyway. But what felt courageous to me were those was the work we did beforehand to clean up our relationship, to have the courageous conversations we'd never had before, to take responsibility for things we had done to hurt each other, to apologize, to hear the other one's point of view, to put down assumptions. And you know what? It was not that hard. We spend years in not having the conversations because we're afraid what will happen. Will I hurt the other? Will I be hurt? Is it safe? What will happen? And I think that in most cases, that fear is so outsized compared to how easy it is and how huge the reward. Now, there are some people, do not try this at home with. There are some people that just will take advantage of you, aren't ready, will be threatened, aren't safe. But I think in most cases, I think of us like awkward teenagers at a dance waiting for someone to invite you. And we all just stand around, you know, like not knowing what to say. I know we could have more intimacy. I know things don't have to be so hard, but I'm not going to be a first. And I think this is like a new kind of first responder, like emotional first responders, the one who's like, screw it. I don't like the way it feels now. I'm willing to risk my vulnerability and say to this person, hey, I think we could do better than we're doing. I don't know what I'm doing to create the tension or the lack of intimacy or whatever between us. I want to hear from you. Could I be doing something better? Have I done something in the past? Do you want to play with me like this? And I have experienced in my own life now, since I've made a study of this, most people are like, wow, thank you. Thank you. Yeah, let's give it a try.
So you have brought it out to after Maggie.
Oh, yeah.
You've lived it.
I felt I made a promise to Maggie that what we went through would not have been done in vain, that I'd try it with my other sisters and with my family and at work. And I've even like in the post-election taken it into like trying to have an open conversation with people who voted differently. So this idea of love being the great healer, like we all spout this, oh, love is the great healer or whatever, all you need is love. Okay, do it. Can we do it? Can we do it with the people we just would rather diss and, like, negate? I've been trying. The operative word is trying.
and it's a muscular love. It's a resilient love. It's not a romantic love. And I think that's maybe something we get confused by. Mm-hmm. Because we talk about love. It's so overused. But there's no other word.
Yeah.
And it means this thing that's, like, tough. It's like what you're describing is
Yeah, it's tough. It's weird. Love is both tough and super soft. You know that posture you see people take in meditation where their back is really straight, but then their chest is like open and their belly's kind of big, and like the Buddha has this like big belly, but the back is really straight. You know, that's love. It's like protective and strong and muscular. It's not an idea. And at the same time, if you're not vulnerable and open and willing to risk your ego, it's really what you're risking, your kind of, your sense of like, I'm right, I must be right, I will not give an inch. Like, that goes in love. That's like, I don't know what I am. Please show me. You tell me what you think I am to you. And can I do the same with you?
It's countercultural. I love it. No, it's, yeah. One of the things I was struck by where gave yourself permission to love is how you were with Maggie in the last days. And I quote, I have another passage here because I loved the way you wrote this. When I got to Oliver and Maggie's, it was where I most wanted to be. It was where the stronger pull of what I really loved led me. The world rushed onward, but I got off the train and stayed in the slow, small backwater of loving one person as best I could for as long as I could. And what delighted me about that was that, one, you like gave yourself permission to love in this really like a countercultural way, maybe. It seems like you shut off so much of the shoulds to follow your heart in that regard. And I don't know, again, I guess that speaks to me of like a woman who's really self-assured and knowing what she wants and has gone through a lot to be self-aware and determined enough to make it happen. So I guess I just wanted to hear you, how you would begin to talk about that aspect of your love.
I guess what's always driven me and inspired me is taking these big concepts that you read about in literature and holy texts and making it real. Like, there is enough wisdom out there in the written word and the spoken word to last forever. It'll last longer than the earth lasts. There's so much wisdom that we all know. But there's a lot less actually doing what the wisdom tells us to do. So I'm really interested in my own life, and because I've been a teacher and a writer, in modeling like the real down and dirty. How do I make this real? If love is what's going to heal tribes and countries and religions and families, how can I make this real in my life so I'm not a phony preaching something? You know, there's so much of, you know, the priest who molests the little boys and the minister who says don't value things who own seven cars. You know, like, that's the far edge of it. But in our own lives, we all could, like, live the truth a lot better. And that's what I'm interested in my own life. And so it gets very small. It's not a huge thing. You don't have to, like, join the United Nations to do your work. The work is like, oh, my sister is dying. She's lonely. She needs help. She doesn't have some of the skills I have. She has other skills, but I'm going in all the way. I'm going in no matter what I have to let go of for however long it takes, because that's love to me in this instance. Just for me and her. I'm not saying everybody has to do this. But that to me was like, what would love do? Love would do this. And so I did it. And the thing is, when you get in the love stream, like you really dive in, it takes you. It wasn't a daily like, and today I'll do this. It was like I got in that river and I just let it take me. And it took me to her. And I'm so grateful I did. Because if she had died without me giving myself to her, I would feel really bad right now. I feel like I did it all the way.
So, there's so much to cover. One of the moments I can't let you go without talking to you about, and I was going to talk about it in a lot of different ways, but I'm just going to throw it out there. Your mom's passing and shooting her, whatever you want to call it, love or restraint, you talk about it very eloquently in the book, to Meg. And I think a while back we were talking about this idea of parents and siblings, and it seemed like you guys were really re-parenting yourself as, I mean, I've thought of that as an individual. You know, we all have little children inside, we want to re-parent, but you really guys came together as sisters and re-parented yourself as an entity, and then rippled out to your other two sisters. But I guess I just wanted to talk about the mystical moment with your mom, and that I don't really know what the question is here, other than this whole sense of love and reparenting and our final act of love at her deathbed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, my mother was a very complicated person. I have a feeling many people would finish this sentence. My mother was a very complicated person. And maybe it was more like children see their parents as very complicated. But my mother was from that generation of women who never really got to choose what they wanted to do. And I don't think she ever would have chosen to have four little girls, bing, bing, bang, run right after the other and give up a career and give up who she wanted to be, an artist, a writer. So she was always a very frustrated mother and not someone who really was giving from a core self, because she really never had been able to develop it. So she kept everything inside. She never shared anything emotionally. We were always second-guessing what was going on with her. So when she died, I think you kind of have this idea that when somebody's on their deathbed, suddenly they, like, become a different person and they spout wisdom and they are emotionally present. Well, it's not true. How you live is how you die. I've been at enough deathbeds now to know that. So when my mother was dying, I don't really think she wanted us girls to be crowded around her and helping her through her dying. But we couldn't help ourselves, you know. We just were trying to crack the code of, who are you, Mom? Can you let us in now? But no. But there was this moment as she was literally dying, her last breaths, where my sister Maggie, and this was before she was diagnosed with cancer, Maggie, very tough person, my sister Maggie, very cynical, really did not believe in many of the things that I believe in or how I've lived my life. Suddenly she went like this. She like had this sense of like something had just been shot into her, and we were like, what? And my mother was having her last breaths, and later she explained to us, as my mother was dying, she felt this bolt of molten orange yellow energy come out of my mother's chest and go into her. And now if I had said that, my sister would go like, oh yeah, there she goes again. But this was like the cynic among us. She's like, I don't know what happened to me, but when she took her last breath, she sent this huge bolt of energy and strength into me. And very soon afterwards, my sister's life fell apart. Her marriage fell apart. She was diagnosed with lymphoma. And I believe, and actually my sister did too, that was my mother gave her last bit of strength, because somehow she knew, this is the girl of the four who's going to need this.
I like have nothing to say to respond to that. Except that, and then you went to that healer person. We won't go into all of that.
You really read the book.
Of course we did. Are you kidding me? Your friend Mark Nepo was here earlier today.
Yeah.
He sends his love.
Oh, I'll be seeing him soon, yeah.
I know. I feel like you guys are like...
Yeah, we are.
Spirits.
We are. It's really funny.
Do you have like...
Oh, we love each other. We see each other once or twice a year. And like we start off where we left off. We just, yeah.
Just jump right in.
Jump right in.
No, because he was like, you're going to see me. And then we talked about your book. I mean, he was just...
Yeah.
There was so much tenderness in his eyes.
I know. Just, he's such a tender fellow.
Oh, he's amazing. So this one is maybe a little self-indulgent for me to ask you about, but as I'm reading you and I'm like, you know, we all do, we put ourselves in our writers who get into our psyches and we feel you. And I kept thinking about the YouTube lyric of trying to throw your arms around the world. And the reason I was thinking that is when you were in therapy with Maggie, you know, you sort of set it up like we're healing our bond, but there was so much, like any healing can, I think it only goes in one direction, which is whole.
Right.
You too. And I think from your writing, my perspective was that you
you have these gifts of sensitivity and empathy and compassion, but you've also got this like blazing intellect and ambition, and you've created so much, and you've got like, go for it. And I felt like you were at one point writing, and correct me if I'm wrong, but this sort of shadow side of that energy of, if I just work hard enough, I can save this, and I'm just gonna just go for it and attack mm-hmm. it. And, I mean, that resonates with me very much. So that's why I'm like, I want to talk to her about
yeah,
this.
Yeah, that's good.
It's, and I don't know what it is about having both of those
right.
that go together, but I think they do, because you feel so much, you want to act so much, and
right.
then you sort of, I sort of go crazy.
Yes.
and I guess I wanted to talk about the peace that comes in your wisdom journey, because it felt like you really made a lot of progress
yeah.
in letting go.
Uh-huh.
And maybe to that effect, as we were talking about at the beginning of the conversation around where are you at now in terms of the impact one magnificent human life can have? What's enough? You know, where is that letting go process played out for
mm-hmm.
you right now?
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to answer that in two ways.
Okay.
First, I'm going to put my feminist hat on. You don't have to use this, but I feel responsible to say it. In my own journey as a spiritual seeker and a socially active person and a feminist, I've become really aware of how, as women, we're always saying, it's too much, I'm too much, I'm being too intense, too much, too aggressive, too energetic, I just am too ambitious. And I'm kind of done with that. Like, because I'm also, I believe, kind and trying at least to take responsibility for actions that may not be inclusive and just, I'm done with tamping down my ambition. Because I think if you're super ambitious, but at the same time inclusive and just, why tamp it down? I think that's a message girls get, and I don't think that's a message boys get. Boys get, go for it. Be successful. Be great. Be big. And I think it's good to be big. The universe is big, and our hearts are big. And ambition can be big, and it can be tempered by love and goodness and justice. But I would focus as a woman more on being more and more just and kind, and put away those voices that say you're too much, you're too aggressive, you're too ambitious. Focus on what you want to be, and then go for it. So I had to say that.
So glad you did.
All right, and then people ask me, what's the biggest thing you learned through this journey with Maggie? And there was this one moment when we were in therapy, and I was lost in a place I often get lost in, which is like, if I just do this perfectly, if I just kind of crack the code, I can like save her life and make her better, and like I can just do it all. Like, and I should, and I must, and I will, and I can. And we were what's called a perfect genetic match. All 10 genetic markers in our marrow cells matched, which is fantastic. The best possible chance for a transplant to work. And so we were called a perfect match. And at one point when I was in therapy with Maggie and doing this big control number I always do, if I can only do it perfectly, she turned to me and she said, you don't have to be perfect to be my perfect match. And that really like crystallized something I'd been trying to learn my whole life, which is you can be good, but you don't have to be perfect. You can't be perfect. None of us can do it perfectly. Whatever our job is, this kind of terror that we're not doing it perfectly, as if there is some place to get to, How could there be? There's never been you before. There's never been you in this job or this relationship before. We're all making it up as we go along. So putting down this fervor to be perfect, which creates so much anxiety and pressure, and instead, no, you are perfect for this moment just because you're here and because you're trying. So I would say that that really rubbed off on me more than anything I've ever done on the journey of the transplant with my sister. You don't have to be perfect to be perfectly matched for another person or a job or life itself.
Thank you. I think I'm so deeply moved. I mean, it's like you're speaking directly to me. You are speaking directly to me, but I just appreciate your channeling of your wisdom in this moment. I just wanted to name that and say that. And two, what's the question? It's something around the messages that we've, it's unconscious on one level. I'm talking about myself. The unconscious, I'm talking about the feminist messages that you just said. Mm-hmm. Forgive me, I'm going off script here. That moment, you know, that perfection, that we're all making it up, that we all are big, and big is good for women. I guess where I'm going with this is just that it's important to say it because, you know, you read it and you and all of the wisdom that's out there. But until you see it play out in your own life and where you're mm-hmm. you're bumping up against that unconscious yeah. messaging, you don't know.
Right. And I felt it. I felt it when you said it to me. Mm-hmm. And you know, I imagine also you as a young man. I often hate to say only feminist, but because I'm a woman and I know there is some gender in it. But I see it in my sons too, especially sons who are raised in this era and maybe raised by feminist moms. Everybody's now afraid to be big, you know, like good young men are afraid to be big because I don't want to step on anyone's toes. But it's just a reframing of the language. It's like, be big and be kind. Don't be small so you don't hurt anyone. No. Be kind and be big.
Because we need more big and yeah. we need more kind. Which we need more of both.
Right.
That's the only thing.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening. I hope you got as much out of this conversation with Elizabeth Lesser as I did. Clearly I did. If you aren't already familiar with her Omega Institute in beautiful Hudson River Valley, New York, please check out their incredible offerings of workshops and retreats. What I love about that place is that it both nourishes me and also compels me to take socially just action. So Elizabeth's memoir, Marrow, is now out in paperback. Definitely encourage you to read that book. And it won its category for Best Memoir in the Books for a Better Life Awards last year, which was really awesome. Okay, thank you for being here. We're so glad you're along for the ride.